from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Hat tip to NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor for perfectly capturing yesterday's Brexit vote in London. Taylor tweeted, U.S. government, look how dysfunctional we are. Then she added, British government, hold my beer. Well, here's exactly how it happened yesterday when Parliament delivered Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan an historic, crushing defeat.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
And so where are we today? Well, the UK still faces a March 29th deadline when it can either have an orderly exit from the European Union or a disastrous one or something else entirely. This hour on Point, Britain in chaos and what it means for its people, for Europe, and for the U.S. And you can join us. What question do you have about yesterday's big Brexit vote in London? Do you see parallels between the political turmoil in London and in Washington? Do you wonder what this will mean for the United States and for the world economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we're going to hear from folks in London, in the European Union, in Brussels, and from Washington today. But let's, of course, begin in London. And joining us is John Peet, political and Brexit editor for The Economist and former Europe editor. We have links to his latest pieces at onpointradio.org. John Peet, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
So first of all, give us a sense as to how crushing Theresa May's Brexit plan defeat was yesterday. How historic was it?
Well, people are saying it is the biggest defeat for a governing party in parliamentary history. So that's quite a long period, a 230-vote loss for a ruling party that, in theory, has a majority, is pretty crushing. And it also is not a trivial issue. The Brexit deal that she brought back to put before Parliament was the central part of her whole programme. And frankly, you might have expected in normal times that that would have led to a resignation and perhaps an election. But we're not going to see either.
Well, and this is a deal that Theresa May has been working on for 2 years. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about the issues or the concerns that members of Parliament had with the deal. But I want to actually play a little bit of tape here because there's so much that happened in Parliament yesterday. For example, here's a moment where the United Kingdom's Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, was warning critics on the Conservative side of Parliament that their political maneuvers could have disastrous consequences.
What are you playing at? What are you doing? You are not children in the playground. You are legislators.
John Peet, what is Geoffrey Cox referring to there, these political games?
Well, I mean, the Conservative Party, like many such parties, contains different factions. But I think the Brexit argument has divided the party more than really anything for over 100 years. And what he's referring to is the fact that there are some Conservative MPs who are very against any concessions to Brussels and want a totally clean break with the European Union. There are many others who are worried about the effect on the economy, who want to stay close to the European Union. And instead of sort of getting on with it and saying, let's find a compromise, they're just sticking to their positions and saying, you know, when Theresa May produces what is a compromise deal, sorry, neither of us like it, and they're just voting against it. And he's saying, you know, your duty is to find a deal before the 29th of March, and they're just not doing that.
So does this not put the United Kingdom then in virtually an impossible position, right? Because the European Union has said May's deal is the best that you're going to get, United Kingdom. You've got, what, 2.5 months before that March 29th deadline. What changes could they possibly make that would rally enough MPs to vote for it?
Well, I think that's going to be very difficult. I mean, it has put the UK in a difficult position. Brussels is familiar with what they like to call ratification difficulties. That's when you agree a treaty with a government and then some countries have difficulty ratifying it. But the process of getting out of those difficulties often takes many months. And in this particular case, with a defeat of this size, it's very difficult to see how the European Union can make changes to the deal that they agreed, the draft treaty they agreed on the sort of scale that would win support among MPs. So I think, you know, we are running out of time and it's very difficult to see a settlement of this issue before 29th of March.
Well, help us understand here in the United States really what's the core or the core set of complaints that all these MPs who voted against Theresa May's plan have? I mean, is it that they want to have their cake and eat it too? They don't want to be part of the union, European Union, but want to enjoy the benefits that they once had? Is it the issue of what was going to happen on the Irish border? I mean, or is it all of it? What is it that really sunk this deal?
I think it is all of it in one sense. I mean, one lot of MPs would like to keep most of the benefits they have now, but not pay any of the costs, including any of the money that the European Union thinks they're owed. Another lot just is very concerned about sovereignty, particularly related to Northern Ireland. And I think what happened in the last few months was that the argument about the Irish border became a general proxy for these kinds of views. And what many MPs were arguing about, including the members of Parliament for the Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, was that in order to avoid any border controls between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, Theresa May had agreed with the European Union that Britain would stay in a customs union and that Northern Ireland would stay very strongly linked to all the rules and regulations of the European Union. And the unionists in Northern Ireland objected that that might mean that they were being differently treated from the rest of the UK. And that's a very sensitive issue, given the history of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And it took with it a lot of Conservatives who were also concerned about any threat to the union of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And that standoff, I think, led to many people saying, we're not going to accept the deal at all.
Huh. Well, I want to play another moment from the many hours of debate that happened yesterday in Parliament in London. Here is Speaker of the House John Bercow repeatedly having to order MPs to stop shouting and arguing. And in this moment, he's scolding a cabinet minister for interrupting an MP as she spoke.
The Prime Minister did not mention Article 50.
Order. People talk about respect in this House, but there's a Minister of the Crown shouting at the Right Honourable Member for Normanton. I say in the kindest way, he's normally a very genial fellow. Stop it. You're capable of much better than that.
That's the Speaker of the British House of Parliament yesterday. John Peet, the idea of talk about respect in this House, what level of respect do the British people right now have for the process that's going on in Parliament?
Well, I'd say two things about that. I mean, the first is that, you know, not if people listening haven't sort of seen how the House of Commons behaves, it's a much rowdier place than the United States Congress. And so there is always quite a lot of shouting going on. And we in Britain get used to that. You hear Prime Minister's questions every Wednesday, and there's a lot of volume of noise and a lot of people shouting all the time. So I think people aren't sort of bothered about that. They think that's the rough and tumble of the Houses of Parliament. But what I also do think is that particularly people who voted in favour of leaving the European Union 2.5 years ago, they're absolutely fed up with the fact that the government and its MPs seem unable to reach any agreement on what the best way of doing that is. So I think Theresa May's government itself has lost credibility, but MPs collectively, including opposition MPs from the Labour Party, are also losing the respect of the people in the country who just think that they're not doing the job they were chosen for.
And take us down to the level of the impact that all of this is going to have on Britain come March 29th. I mean, I was actually listening to the BBC's domestic service that's broadcast in the UK. I was listening to that this morning, and there were a couple of stories about, say, grocery stores and even individuals thinking, well, we're going to have to stockpile food because there's a great uncertainty about supply chains coming, you know, in and out of the European Union if the United Kingdom has a hard Brexit on March 29th. I mean, is the reality of what could happen really starting to settle in there?
I think as this deadline gets closer, you know, this deadline was set 2 years ago because the process of leaving the European Union, you have to send a letter to Brussels and under the procedures laid down in the treaty, 2 years later, you're due to leave whatever happens. And as we get closer to that time when, in theory at least, Britain is supposed to leave whatever happens, yes, I think many people are worrying. I mean, businesses generally are worried because there could be disruption to the flow of trade between Britain and continental Europe that could threaten supply chains in the car industry, and for example. But there is also sort of more mundane worries that people are pointing out. Quite a lot of the medicines that we have in Britain are imported from continental Europe, and so is about 40% of the food that we eat. Most people don't really think that if it came to it, there would be a sort of, you know, kind of rationing or anything like that. But the possibility of disruption is clearly there. And I think that is one of the reasons why people are getting more anxious and more excited and more worried about what has been going on in the House of Commons this week.
So, John Peet, I mean, we'll also talk about Theresa May's political future in just a couple of minutes here. But regardless of who is Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, I mean, what happens next now that May's plan has been so resoundingly defeated?
Well, I think it's quite difficult to predict what exactly will happen next. I mean, she's going to go on as Prime Minister despite this defeat. She takes the view that a deal or that looks quite like the deal that was rejected is still the most likely option. She said she does not want to leave the European Union with a disruptive no deal that we were just talking about, which could, you know, cause serious problems for business and ordinary daily life. But she's willing to consult her colleagues in her cabinet and in the House of Commons to see what other sort of possible changes can be made, what other possibilities there are for reaching an agreement on how Britain should leave, and then go back to her European Union counterparts and see what she can negotiate. I think the consensus that I hear is that would point to a softer version of Brexit than the one that she was proposing before, but nobody can really be quite sure where it would end up.
This is the theme of Britain's two-year Brexit turmoil thus far. Nobody really knows. Well, John Peet, political and Brexit editor for The Economist, stand by here for just a second. We're talking about yesterday's resounding defeat of Theresa May's Brexit plan in the United Kingdom, what it means for the UK, for Europe, and of course for the UK's primary ally here in us, here in the United States. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Theresa May's Brexit plan, which suffered a crushing defeat in the UK Houses of Parliament yesterday. And actually, let's just play a little bit of what Theresa May herself said when her plan suffered a big defeat. And here's a moment from that.
Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold.
That's the British Prime Minister Theresa May telling her restive MPs it's easy enough to vote against something, but what are you for? And that was inside the Houses of Parliament yesterday. Outside, protesters on opposing sides were gathered as the MPs debated inside. And here's a couple of protesters getting into quite an argument.
How much is this country going to lose if we can?
It's not going to lose anything.
How do you know that?
As you know, it's going to lose.
Well, the
How do you know it's going to lose? Prove to me. Prove to me it's going to lose.
Do you trust the government to tell you?
Prove to me it's going to lose.
Those are British protesters outside the Houses of Parliament debating Brexit yesterday. John Peet is with us. He's political and Brexit editor for The Economist and a former Europe editor as well. He's with us from London. Joining us now from Brussels is David Herzenhorn, chief Brussels correspondent for Politico Europe. We have links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. David, it's good to have you back.
Great to be with you.
Also with us is Amanda Sloat, Senior Fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. She's also a fellow with the Project on Europe and the Transatlantic Relationship at Harvard's Kennedy School's Belfer Center. She's with us from Washington. Amanda Sloat, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, David, let me first start with you. We talked with John in the first part of the program about exactly what happened yesterday in Parliament. As all of this was unfolding, what was the reaction from the European Union?
Well, the reaction in the European Union actually had come even before this vote. They knew what was coming, and they've seen over the past 2 years this exact same pattern, which is the UK as a country is so thoroughly divided, it doesn't know what it wants. And this is the problem in the Parliament. You know, legislators don't vote far from what their voters want them to do. And in this case, they don't know what to vote for because the country is so thoroughly divided and confused about what sort of future it wants upon leaving the EU, or if it wants to leave the EU.
Now, Jean-Claude Juncker has said this is the best deal that he thinks the EU is going to be able to offer the United Kingdom. But I'm reading here that is there the possibility that May, you know, if she has a political future as prime minister, that she could basically kind of go hat in hand back to the European Union and just ask for a delay, at least on that March 29th Brexit deadline?
Not just with hat in hand. I mean, there's no question about this. Now, we have to keep in mind that what Juncker's saying is a bit exaggerated, right? The best deal is only a deal that can be ratified and that will accomplish the EU's goals, which are to prevent an economic catastrophe, to prevent this no-deal scenario. But Theresa May cannot just come back to Brussels having suffered this defeat. What they're looking for now is for her to make good on something she said in those remarks, if you continue on what you were playing, where she promised, upon surviving this vote of no confidence, if she can survive the vote of confidence, to open up a dialogue with all of the parties, including her opposition in the Labour Party, something she has not done throughout this process. This was a big signal for EU27 leaders back at their summit in December. They're all veterans of legislative battles in their home capitals. And they looked at this situation and they realized that the European Commission seemed to have a better line of communication open to Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, than Theresa May did. This would be, you know, the Republicans not talking to Democrats, and everybody realizes, hey, there's no way you're going to cobble together the votes on such a complicated thing if these two parties, the main parties, are not talking to each other. So she's promised to do that. So the view in Brussels is, hey, work it out over there, have a dialogue amongst yourselves. Then come back to Brussels and let us know what it is we can do for you. They're willing to extend that March 29th deadline. They've signaled that, but not for an open-ended purpose. They want to know, what are we waiting for? Is it for a national election? Is it for a second referendum? Is it for some other clear signpost that she can give for when this is going to get done? But they run up against another deadline, which is the seating of a new European Parliament. There are EU elections in May, and then, more crucially, the results of those elections have to be implemented. A new parliament has to be seated in early July. And if we get to the point where the UK is not out then, they have the equivalent of a constitutional crisis, a treaty crisis, where you need to have the UK represented in the parliament, even though they're about to leave. So if the UK hasn't had elections or figured out some other mechanism to maintain its representation in the European Parliament, but it's still in, that's problematic. So even with an extension, they've got some trouble ahead in sorting out exactly how it'll work.
Right. Well, Amanda Sloat, let me turn to you in Washington. I keep thinking as we watch what's happening in the United Kingdom about that historic special relationship that the US and the UK have had. I mean, what are we here in the United States to make of this moment in this long Brexit drama?
Well, I think some Americans are finding it interesting to watch what's happening in the UK because it's a nice distraction from the chaos that we have facing our own government here in Washington, which is currently shut down, of course. So we're really seeing a lot of dysfunction on both sides of the Atlantic, which runs the risk of being able to work together more broadly, confronting a lot of the larger global challenges that are facing us all.
You know, it's interesting because is it fair to say that the United States has often seen in the context of this special relationship, the UK as being its sort of ambassador to the rest of Europe? And when the United States wanted to sort of institute some global action, I mean, I'm thinking about Tony Blair and his selling of the Iraq War.
The UK certainly has been America's entree into the European Union. The UK has always been the most like-minded with the United States on broader political terms, generally on economic terms. The Iraq War is one example, although probably for Tony Blair and his reputation, George Bush, not the best example of cooperation that ended up working out well. But if you look at the way the EU tends to make policy, the U.S. often goes to the U.K. first. The U.K. has been quite like-minded with the United States on the question of sanctions, for example, against Russia in response to Ukraine and other things that have happened. And so one of the questions for the U.S. with the U.K. leaving is how it's going to approach the European Union, who is going to be its like-minded ally within EU decision-making, since I think we're often stronger when the United States and the European Union are able to do joint policies.
Okay. And so, Amanda, I believe there are economic reasons, too, why the United States should be closely watching what's happening here. Because if I'm reading this correctly, the United Kingdom is, what, the fourth largest export destination for American goods and services?
That's right. So there's two aspects of this. One is if we end up having a chaotic no-deal Brexit, there are going to be implications for American businesses that are currently operating in London. There's a lot of confusion and chaos for businesses now because they don't know how this is going to play out. They don't know how they need to prepare. You're seeing some businesses that have been shifting out of London and establishing different headquarters elsewhere on the European continent. There's also the potential for broader chaos in international markets if you do have a very disorderly UK withdrawal from the European Union. The second side of this is the question about what a trade deal looks like between the United States and the United Kingdom. Both Donald Trump and Theresa May have talked about wanting to have some sort of free trade agreement with the United States. The challenge is that Donald Trump clearly has positioned himself as a very good deal maker and a tough negotiator on trade deals. So there's some questions about whether or not Theresa May in a much weaker position is going to be forced to accept things that might not necessarily be advantageous to the country. The other piece of that is the UK is going to have to decide where it wants to align itself. On one hand, it would make sense for them to align more closely with the European Union in regulatory terms, since, as the previous speaker was saying, 40% of their food comes from there. So to stay aligned with the EU on environmental, on agriculture, on food products would be sensible for them. On the other hand, the United States, for example, allows genetically modified food. Mm-hmm. And so if the UK has a trade deal with the US and decides to accept genetically modified food, which presumably is something the Trump administration is going to push for, it's going to complicate their ability to trade with the European Union.
Well, let's turn back to John Peet then in London. John, what's your take on the on all the considerations that Amanda and David have brought to the table now?
Well, I mostly agree with them. I think David is right that the rest of Europe would like this problem to be sorted out, so they're not very pleased by what happened this week. I do think that they would be willing to extend the deadline if we get into a sort of crunch. But they don't want to extend the deadline, say, for another 6 months or so, just for more debate inside the UK. So I think they would probably want to extend the deadline with some knowledge about what would happen. You know, is it being extended because we're going to have another referendum? Is it being extended because we've now got a different solution and we just need a bit more time to pass the necessary laws? But neither side would want Britain to crash out on the 29th of March with no deal. So I think when it comes to a crunch, some way will be found of giving the process more time. I think also Amanda put her finger on a much broader general problem about what happens to Britain post-Brexit. I mean, does it stay reasonably closely aligned with the European Union, which is its biggest trading partner and which it's been used, businesses in Britain are used to dealing with? Or does it break away more clearly and sort of become more of a sort of floater around the world? And I think the answer to that at the moment is probably it's going to end up staying more closely aligned to the European Union. Mm-hmm. I mean, in particular, the sort of example that she was quoting of food standards. It's clear that for British farmers and indeed for the sake of the Irish border, Britain will, the United Kingdom will need to stay quite closely aligned to European food standards, which would mean no to GMOs, no to chlorinated chicken, and so on. But if that is the course that it takes, it's going to be much harder to envisage any free trade deal with the United States.
Yeah. Well, John Peet, David Herzenhorn, and Amanda Sloat, stand by here for just a second because we are indeed talking about the crushing defeat of Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan in Parliament in London yesterday and what that means in terms of next steps for the United Kingdom as it heads toward that March 29th Brexit deadline, what it means for the United States and its relationship with the UK and the global economy as well. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I'm from Portland, Maine, but I lived in England for 17 years, and I'm a dual US-UK citizen, and I'm proud to say I voted against Brexit when I was still in the UK. However, and it's a mess, there's no question about it, I did want to take issue with the opening statement from your reporter saying that somehow the United States, Britain is worse off than the United States. I think one really important thing on the Brexit vote is that over 100 Tory MPs voted against the party in the hopes to do the right thing for Britain. And that is sorely lacking, I think, in our Congress, voting strictly on along party lines. And maybe the lesson we could take is it's time to break some party lines. Thank you.
Tom, thank you for your call. Amanda Sloat, let me turn back to you on that because, you know, to just to dovetail with Tom's point, they at least had a vote. We haven't had a vote yet, at least in the Senate, on reopening parts of the U.S. government here. But what do you think about what Tom said?
Well, we can certainly go down a rabbit hole of U.S. domestic politics. I think politicians would argue that there have been a number of votes over the last couple of months on various budget deals containing varying degrees of funding for Trump's wall. And I think we really do have a political standoff here. The challenge, I think, in the U.K., and I think John was alluding to this in his opening comments, is you have a lot of divides in different parts of the country, and you also have a lot of divides within the political party. You know, it's important to remember that Theresa May was not supportive of Brexit and only became prime minister when her predecessor, David Cameron, resigned after the Brexit deal collapsed. So you've got divides within the Conservative Party about what people support. You've got divides in different parts of the country. And so I think it does create problems for MPs in the UK in terms of whether they support or vote along certain party lines or whether they vote along some of their constituents' interests.
Hmm. David Herzenhorn, let me turn back to you here for just a second because there's so many little details that I want to try and get our minds around as well. So this is a slight departure from where we were earlier. But did I read earlier that in the last couple of days or the last week that members of the European Parliament, did they write a letter or express to the United Kingdom that, you know, we hope that you don't leave the European Union? What's going on with the European Parliament?
Well, the European Parliament is still on track to ratify this same deal. I mean, what they want to do is create a situation where up until the last minute, if that March 29th deadline holds, the UK can essentially change its mind, approve this withdrawal treaty, and be on its way. Of course, there are people in Brussels and throughout the EU who have regretted the Brexit referendum from the start, who have never wanted the UK to leave. And maybe leading the pack there is the European Council President Donald Tusk, a former Prime Minister of Poland, who tweeted yesterday he was sort of very cheeky, playing on a comment that Theresa May had been making in her argument to the House of Commons, where she would say the choices are my deal, no deal, or no Brexit. And Tusk's tweet essentially said, well, it's impossible to make a deal, and everybody says they don't want no deal, who will have the courage to say what the only positive alternative is? Obviously, what he's alluding to is the idea that the UK would stay. We don't think that's going to happen. But again, there's been this persistent desire, hope, dream, you might say, among some in the EU that the UK would stay. But they haven't pressured. They've been very careful because they know sort of anything they do in that regard might backfire. They don't want to have any negative effect. I mean, talking about the link to Trump, we should keep in mind that the U.S. government has been anything but helpful to Theresa May in getting this deal through. In fact, the U.S. ambassador said that, you know, noting that the president had trashed her deal, saying she got a terrible deal, said it looked doubtful that there could be a trade deal with the U.S. If, in fact, this deal got through. So she hasn't had a lot of help, even from her special friends in Washington.
Well, John Peet, we have a minute to go before we have to take another break here, but I want to explore another one of the potential avenues the next steps in Brexit might take. I mean, I'm seeing here that is it even possible that Parliament would intervene or perhaps even take over the process?
Well, it's very interesting, and it's interesting in the context of the parallels between the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament. I mean, I was in Washington in the early 90s, and I got used to the idea that Republicans and Democrats would work together, and, you know, you'd get different people, different parties across sort of pushing through legislation. That seems to have stopped in the U.S. It's now much more clear that Republicans stick with themselves and so do Democrats, and you have your standoff. The opposite has happened in Britain, and actually there is quite a lot of move for cross-party collaboration, particularly over Brexit. And one form of that is that there are groups of Conservative and Labour MPs who want to take control of the whole process. And that how that works out could be very influential on what actually happens next.
Well, John Peet, David Herzenhorn, and Amanda Sloat, stand by. We are talking about next steps in Brexit after yesterday's historic defeat of Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan. We got some comments coming in online on Facebook. Bob Ziegler says Britain wants a divorce on its own terms, but that's not how divorce works in any situation. What's your take? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Brexit. Yesterday in London, Prime Minister Theresa May suffered an historic defeat for her Brexit plan in a vote in the House of Commons. That means, once again, we're asking, what's next for Brexit? We're joined today by John Peet. He's with us from London. He is political and Brexit editor for The Economist. David Herzenhorn is with us from Brussels. He's chief Brussels correspondent for Politico Europe. And Amanda Sloat joins us as well. She's in Washington. She's senior fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. John, David, and Amanda, I want to play a little bit of tape here because of all the, you know, many possibilities of what could happen next. I think some people are beginning to wonder, could another referendum be on the horizon? Because, of course, it was that June referendum in the summer of 2016 that first got Brexit in motion. And none other than Nigel Farage, he's the former head of the UK Independence Party, that is the hard right, extremely Eurosceptic party in the United Kingdom, on Sky News, he is predicting almost gleefully a second referendum.
The rest of the world is looking on with incredulity at what they think is a great country being led so badly in such a shambolic way. So it's not good for our standing in the world. It's not good for investment into Britain. We need a resolution. There is a way out. It is the legislation. We should leave on March the 29th. I still hope and pray that happens, but I fear, as I said, that we're going to get an extension of Article 50. And what you will hear are voices in Westminster pushing hard for a second referendum, even though there is no real will for it.
Well, that's Nigel Farage. Let's go to Nate, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me. That was actually one of the few questions I wanted to slip in, because the polls have been indicating Brexit less popular in the UK. I also wanted to ask about if there were any allegations of Putin promoting a Brexit because he supported anti-EU politicians in France, and the EU certainly makes his kleptocracy look bad. Also, would the UK potentially face some breakups of its own if it took a hard Brexit, like with Scotland and North Ireland?
Ah, interesting. So three good questions there, Nate. John Peet, let's start with the first one. Any possibility of a second referendum?
Well, I think it is much more possible today than it was a year ago. I don't think popular sentiment is changing quite as fast as some enthusiasts believe. But, you know, as time passes, it's 2.5 years since the referendum, more young people come onto the voter register. I think most pollsters think that a referendum held today would probably narrowly go the other way. And I think that is that, and the fact that Parliament seems unable to agree on any form of Brexit is helping to boost those who think, you know, maybe we should have another look at this issue. I would not say that is still the most likely outcome, but I think it is more plausible than it was.
Well, so David Herzenhorn, just jumping to the EU for a moment here, how would the EU look upon, say it happened, a second referendum?
Well, the EU would be very uneasy, but obviously there are folks who would welcome that on the belief that, in fact, the vote would go the other way. One thing I've noted is that, in response to the questioner, is that the Brexit process started with everyone talking and speculating about the breakup of the EU, and it looks like it's ending with everyone talking about the potential breakup of the UK, concerns both about Northern Ireland and the reunification of Ireland, concerns about what it means for Scotland. So it's funny how these things can boomerang in ways that you just don't expect.
Well, John Peet, is that serious talk then, that Scotland, which voted overwhelmingly for remaining in the EU, would seriously consider, another independence vote?
Well, of course, the Scottish National Party has been wanting to have a second independence vote for some time. And I think it is certainly true that if and when Britain finally does leave the European Union, given that Scotland voted strongly to stay in the European Union, that will give them an extra sort of boost to the demands for another independence vote. And there are questions about the future of Northern Ireland raised by the Irish border. I think in both cases, it's still some way off. But the question of the unity of the United Kingdom is going to be an issue post-Brexit for some time to come. In both cases, I would think actually that Northern Ireland would probably want to stay, so long as a majority of unionists favour that, and Scotland would want to think twice about whether to break the single market link with England, which is by far its biggest market. So I wouldn't exaggerate it, but I think they are on the table.
Well, and John, the third question that our caller had about Vladimir Putin and his support for anti-European MPs, or actually I should say more broadly, Russia's role, if any, in the original Brexit referendum. What do you
have? Well, it is interesting that you should raise that. And yes, clearly, just as in the election of Donald Trump, the question of what role Russia has played is out there. And indeed, Russian links, both financial and personal, with people like Nigel Farage and the UK Independence Party. It was always clear that Putin would be delighted if Britain voted to leave the European Union, because he thinks the European Union is kind of one of his enemies. And indeed, Nigel Farage was closely linked with Donald Trump before he was elected. So there is a sort of miasma around there of Russian involvement, Russian money being involved. Some of the biggest donors to the Vote Leave campaign also had strong links with Russia. I think that's a long way from saying that it is because of Russia that Vote Leave won the campaign in 2016. But certainly there's something of a sort of bad smell about Russian links. And Vladimir Putin still today makes clear that he would be delighted if Brexit goes through and very disappointed if it didn't.
Well, Amanda Sloat, this brings me to a comment on our website, onpointradio.org, that someone calling themselves Jaso Turner, has put up, saying, "I think that Brexit and the Trump election are both signal indicators of the loss of civic engagement in democratic politics. And when civic engagement is either lost or suppressed, mischief is carried out against average citizens." I wonder what you make of that.
I think there is an argument on both sides that a lack of full understanding, I think, of the complexities of what Brexit actually entailed. And in the United States, I think a lack of some civic education in schools about how policy processes work has contributed to some of the confusion in both countries. I think that in both sides, one of the benefits coming out of this is certainly in the UK, people have become a lot more aware of the European Union, what UK membership in the EU actually entails. And one of the silver linings I think we're seeing in the United States in response to a lot of the chaos that we've had recently is people becoming much more civically engaged. One thing I would add on the previous caller's question would be to plug a report that I wrote and published on the Brookings website in October, looking in much greater detail about the implications of Brexit for Scotland and Northern Ireland. Because I do think that there is a potential risk to the future unity of the UK. I agree with John that this is not likely to happen in the near term, but I do think it is raising pretty significant questions for both Scotland and Northern Ireland that could be affected, especially if you have a very messy Brexit going forward.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Larry, who's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Larry, you're on the air.
Hello. Just want to maybe draw a similarity between England and the United States. It was my understanding that one of the major reasons why England wanted to leave the European Union was because of the open border situation, where they were having trouble controlling the influx or the flood of people from other countries into their country. And again, United States seems to be going down this exactly parallel course with our border wall, where we're having an influx and being overrun and flooded by people from other countries and not being able to control that. So just wanted to draw that similarity. Your guest was elaborating on that a little bit and wonder if that is, does he feel that's part of the reason why they want to leave the European Union.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for your call. I would say it's probably a major reason why a lot of people voted to leave the European Union in the United Kingdom. But the difference is, of course, European Union membership requires the free flow of people and labor across EU borders for EU citizens, whereas in the United States, we have an actual hard border between the United States and Mexico. But David Herzenhorn, let me just dovetail off what Larry is saying here. And you know, was there ever any possibility that the European Union might have found some kind of room for compromise over that free flow of labor, the immigration issues that so many people in the UK did and do take quite a hard line against?
No, I mean, freedom of movement is one of the four fundamental freedoms of the EU, which make its single market possible. You can't really compare that to the U.S. unless you compare to the movement of workers across state lines.
Right.
That's the more logical comparison. What you also can say, though, where there is a similarity, is not the immigration issue, but the myths and fears and sort of overblown rhetoric around immigration is true in both cases, right? We know that even under a Brexit scenario, immigration would go up in the UK. The UK needs an influx of immigrants for its labor force, for its economy. The fears there are really overblown, were overblown and exaggerated. There are also things that the UK could have done under the EU's existing rules and its treaties to have a greater control and sort of a bureaucratic check on who was coming into the country, which it didn't do. It actually had one of the more lenient policies. Other EU countries do have a greater, a more strict system of registering workers, knowing who's where. So there are steps the UK could have taken that it never did take. And a lot of people point to that and say, hey, if you'd done this sooner and used the rights and privileges you had under the EU treaties, you wouldn't have had this kind of overblown rhetoric about the Polish plumbers, et cetera. But in both cases, it's been very nasty rhetoric in the US and in the UK. That seems to be where the only similarity really lies.
Right. Well, John Peet, you're there in London. I mean, I also remember hearing around the time the Brexit vote happened, you know, reports from, port cities or coastal towns about social services straining under the pressure of a lot of people coming into the UK. I mean, were the fears overblown?
Well, I would share David's views. I think they were overblown. I mean, in retrospect, the referendum occurred at the worst possible time because that was the peak for migration into the UK from the rest of the European Union. But even then, at that peak, more migrants were coming into the UK net from outside the European Union. So the idea that we needed to leave the European Union in order to bring an end to migration was never very convincing. And it's actually migration from the European Union has fallen very substantially, and there's not very much of it going on now. I think the other thing that happened, and this again is shared a little bit in other countries in Europe and perhaps to some extent in the United States, is people have often said, well, look, all these migrants are flooding into the country and they're costing us a lot of money, they're claiming benefits, and as a result they're filling up our hospitals and so on. There was never any real truth in that, because people who migrate from one country to another tend to do so to work. And economists have repeatedly shown that migration is associated with a net contribution to the taxpayer and the exchequer, and not to a net cost. And I think that debate has been rather poisonous. I like to think it's becoming less poisonous, but sometimes I think it still persists.
Mm. Well, let's get another call. Susan is calling from Watertown, South Dakota. Susan, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. What would the best and worst case scenario be in the Brexit decision or indecision for a typical British family, as far as economic impact, jobs, etc.? Thank you.
Susan, I actually really appreciate the elegant simplicity of that question. Thank you for your call. John Pete, let me ask you that. What do you think? Best and worst case scenarios for a typical British family?
Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, economists have looked at this at the macroeconomic level, and that would translate into the typical British family. A Brexit with no deal would clearly do the most damage to the British economy, and would therefore be most challenging for the typical British family. And a Brexit with a much softer version, a deal that does actually keep quite closely aligned with the European Union, would be the least damaging. And actually, of course, back to your question about another referendum, the least damaging option of all would be if Britain were to decide to stay in the European Union after all.
Well, but David Herzenhorn, this sort of circles us back to where we first brought you into the conversation. Is there time enough? Is there certainty in terms of the political situation in the United Kingdom, enough certainty there to come up with a softer Brexit deal that could pass Parliament, that the European Union would say okay to?
There clearly isn't enough time for a big shift, at least not before March 29th. So what would have to happen is there would have to be a request for an extension with a signal to Brussels that, in fact, Theresa May and her political rivals in the Labour Party were engaged in a debate that looked like it was actually going somewhere. You know, the question about what's best for everyday citizens, you know, it's this myth that the UK could get away from the EU. You know, the islands aren't moving. You know, in this globalized world, there's only so much separating that you can do. And so that perception that, oh, you know, the UK could live on its own happily ever after and not ever have to worry about the EU again, that's just not true.
Well, Amanda Sloat, we've got about a minute or so left here to go. You know, you're there in Washington. I was just wondering what your last thoughts are on lessons or things that we here in the United States ought to be thinking about or focusing on as we continue to watch what happens with the United Kingdom.
I think that there certainly should be a hope in the United States that the UK is able to resolve this quickly. My concern is that this is going to continue to be a years-long process. Even if there is a Brexit deal agreed, it's going to be time-consuming for the UK to resolve its future relationship with the European Union. If there is a no-deal Brexit, that's going to be very messy and consume a lot of the bandwidth in London. I think both of our countries are really mired in domestic politics. We have incredibly divided societies and polarized populations. And I think this is doing a disservice to the track record that both of our countries have had to be a force for good and able to operate effectively on the global scale. And so hopefully both governments are able to continue to find ways to move past these challenges. I think both countries need to do a lot of healing in terms of addressing internal visions that are plaguing us and be able to move forward, to be able to work in a much more proactive and effective way.
Well, Amanda Sloat, senior fellow in the Center for on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, with us from Washington. Thank you so much for joining us today. And David Herzenhorn, chief Brussels correspondent for Politico Europe, with us from Brussels. David, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks.
And John Pete, political and Brexit editor for The Economist and former Europe editor as well, with us from London. John Pete, thank you very much and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Folks, go to onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio and let us know what you think about lessons we here in the U.S. ought to learn from what's happening in the U.K. with Brexit. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.